Well, when we meet Pinchas in the beginning of this week's parsha, we actually meet two people. For as we know, we have a double vision with regards to Pinchas. Pinchas is himself, his original, the Pinchas ben Elazar, in the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, acting as he does with Zimri and Cosby. And Pinchas then goes on to become Eliyahu Hanavi. That's a Masorah that we have. And as Chazal expound on the words from the Haftorah, actually. It's the Haftorah for Parshas Pinchas, although not every year do we actually read it, because when Pinchas is in the 3 weeks, the Tlos of the Paranusa, they take over. But during peacetime, when Pinchas is read before the 3 weeks, then we have the Haftorah, which deals with Eliyahu, and that's the connection between them, because Pinchas is Eliyahu, and he has his own kanos going on. And when Hashem appears to him and says, Malacha po Eliyahu, what are you doing here? What brings you here? So Eliyahu says, Kano kinesi l'Hashem tzavokos, I have indeed been zealous on Hashem's behalf. And the double expression, Kano kinesi, is picked up on by Chazal. Because there are, in fact, two famous episodes of kanaos, of zealousness, on Pinchas's behalf. Firstly, kanaos, says the Medrash, b'shitim, in our parsha, with Baal Peor, what he did with Zimri and Cosby. That's kanaos number one. And then kanaos number two is his famous showdown with the prophets of Baal in the Haftorah, in Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Ches, which is actually the Haftorah for Parshas Kisisa, the actual confrontation, and then the fallout is the Haftorah for Parshas Pinchas. Kano Kinesi. Once as Pinchas, once as Eliyahu. In our experience, we make room for Eliyahu HaNavi on another well-known occasion, and that is the occasion of Mila, at a bris. And there is the child is placed on what's called the Kiseh Shel Eliyahu, and Eliyahu is considered to be, in one form or another, at every bris, not in physical form, as he can sometimes appear. The Gemara states in Eruvin, if he appears in physical form, he's bound by halachas. There's no way he could visit all brises on Shabbos without violating the Isra of Tchum Shabbos. So as the Chasam Sofer points out, that's if he's Pinchas the person. But if he's Pinchas, what's called Eliyahu Malach HaBris, so then he's is not subject to these rules, and he indeed is present in that form in every bris. And the background to Eliyahu's presence, I mean, how does he come to be have this vocation that he visits every bris? The background is in the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, one of the oldest collections of Midrashim that we have. And it relates to Hashem's conversation with Eliyahu HaNavi. This is in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, in the end of Perek Kaftes. Amarlo, Eliyahu says to Hashem, Kano kinesi, the expression that we've been referring to. I've been zealous twice. Amarlo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Eliyahu HaNavi, La'olam ata mekaneh, you're constantly being zealous on my behalf. Kinesa v'shitim, you were zealous in the episode of Shitim, that's Pinchas ben Elazar. V'kanata mekaneh, and so to hear with the prophets of Baal, Chayecha, by your life, She'en Yisrael osim bris mila, ad shataroa be'einecha. And therefore your reward, seemingly, is that whenever B'nai Yisrael do a bris, you'll be there. Because you were zealous on behalf of the bris. Eliyahu says, Kano kinesi, if we will see Mitz Hashem soon, the psukim in the Haftorah, it's brischa heferu. They violated your bris, they disrupted your bris. And therefore, because he's so active for the covenant between Hashem and B'nai Yisrael, he is present whenever that bris is then reaffirmed in the form of each new child who is nichnas lebris. Mikanit kinu chachamim. It's based on this that the chachamim instituted. Shu osim moshav kovod lemalach habris. They should make a special seat, kisei shel Eliyahu, for Eliyahu who's called malach habris. That's where it comes from. And the way that we have intoned and the way that we have explained what the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar is saying is that in rewards for his constant efforts, being zealous on Hashem's behalf, Eliyahu gets to participate and to be present in every bris. That's his nachas. However, it's very interesting to note that not everyone understands what the Pirkei Belezer is saying in that way, that Eliyahu's presence at every bris is as a reward. And the background to perhaps the other approach is elsewhere in the Medrash, in the Michilta. And interestingly, this is the opening discussion of the entire Michilta. In Parshas Bo, which is really where the Michilta begins. And the Medrash divides three, shall we say, categories of Nevi'im and gives classic examples of each. Shlosha Nevi'im Heim. There are three types of Nevi'im, three approaches amongst the Nevi'im. Echad, Tova Kavod Ha'av Kavod HaBen. There is one who claims the honor both of the father and of the son. That is to say, he claims and works on behalf of Hashem's honor and also B'nai Yisrael's honor. There are some who are working for both. Ve'echad tova kvod ha'av v'lo kvod ha'ben. There's another type of Navi who he only seems to be representing the honor of Hashem, not so much looking out for the honor of or promoting the honor of the Jewish people. And then you have the opposite. Ve'echad tova kvod ha'ben v'lo kvod ha'av. There's other Nevi'im another Navi, who he really was working to promote the honor of the son, that is B'nai Yisrael, and not Hashem himself. The example that we're not going into the details of the first, which is Tovea both of them, is Yirmiyahu HaNavi. The Medrash says he was Tovea both of them, and therefore that was considered a very good tenure. But then you have Eliyahu. Tova kvod ha'av v'lo kvod ha'ben. We see that when Eliyahu is talking, he's always looking out for Hashem's honor, and never seemingly, these are harsh words, but the Medrash says, never seemingly the honor of the Jewish people. Shenemar kano kinesi l'Hashem tzavokos. I've been zealous on Hashem's behalf. And the Medrash states, well, were you ever zealous on the Jewish people's behalf, or only on Hashem's behalf? Uma ne'emar. And the Medrash again follows up on this and says, if you look in the Pasuk, again it's from the Haftorah of this week's Parsha, what is Eliyahu told to do after having made this statement, this pronouncement, Kano kinesi l'Hashem tzavokos? He's told to make certain appointments, to appoint a king of Aram, a king of Yisrael, and a new Navi. Vayomer lech l'darkecha midbar Damesek. He's got to appoint Yehu as the king on Yisrael. Fine. Achav's days are numbered. And who's the new Navi? Elisha. Elisha ben Shaphat, Timshach leNavi Tachtecha. And Elisha ben Shaphat, you shall anoint as a Navi Tachtecha in your stead. And the Medrash says that word, that extra word, tachtecha, instead of you, it really sounds that Eliyahu is not so much being succeeded, but he's being replaced. She'ein tam lo melavi tachtecha. You know what it means, tachtecha, instead of you? Ela she'i if she benevuasecha. Hashem says to Eliyahu, I can't take your, I have no interest in your nevuah, because you're only looking out for my kavod, you never stick up for the kavod of the Jewish people, so you're fired. But that's what happened to Eliyahu, which is a major chiddush. Who's on the other side, by the way? Who's the one that's toveh kvod ha-ben and not kvod ha-av, only seemingly looking out for the honor of the Jewish people at the expense of Hashem's honor, so to speak? Yonah Navi. Yonah tova kvod ha-ben v'lo kvod ha-av. Because he will do anything possible to avoid indicting the Jewish people, making them look bad. That, as we know, was his reason for trying to run away, that he shouldn't receive nevuah. He doesn't want to tell Nineveh that they should do tshuva. Not because he was afraid that they wouldn't do tshuva. He was afraid that they would. The Jewish people, in the meanwhile, not yet doing tshuva, and therefore it would reflect badly. And therefore he's prepared to try and evade or avoid Hashem and evade his word in order not to reflect badly on the Jewish people. And the Medrash says this precedent this precedent, even in earlier Nevi'im, for sticking up for the covenant of Bnei Yisrael in Moshe Rabbeinu, where when Hashem says they've served idolatry and they've made the egel and I'm going to destroy them, and Moshe says you're going to have to take me with them also. He sticks up for them and he puts himself out for them and pleads their cause. And he's considered to be the archetypical Navi who pleads the cause of the children, not just of Hashem. Interestingly, before we get back to Eliyahu, important to note, Yonah seems to be grouped together with Moshe Rabbeinu. They're both Tovea Kvod Haben. They're always looking out for the Jewish people. Except Moshe Rabbeinu, his efforts were accepted, whereas Yonah's were not. As if to say, when Moshe says, "Becheini nami sifracha," under no circumstances, I'm not going to just stand here and let you destroy the Jewish people, seemingly siding with them, Hashem accepts it and endorses it. It's considered to be correct. But when Yonah avoids Nevuah in order not to indict the Jewish people, it's not acceptable. Hashem catches up with him. He goes out to sea. Hashem sends a fish and brings it back. But the question is, if Yonah really is in the same camp as Moshe, how come Moshe's efforts were accepted, but Yonah's were not? Well, I believe, perhaps the answer very simply, I hope not oversimply, is that within Moshe's situation, the only thing that happened as a result of sticking up for the Jewish people was a benefit, as if to say the Jewish people were saved. If he had heeded Hashem's words, they'd be destroyed. Because he puts himself out for them, they're saved. It's pure benefit. No one suffers. Yonah actually took this position, this shita, to a new extreme, because he's prepared for a city with thousands and thousands of people to perish in order that that should not reflect badly on the Jewish people. That's a little bit too far. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not prepared to accept. And therefore, certainly where he's coming from is laudable and praiseworthy, but it was not accepted in the end. And Hashem says, I have to have Rachmanos on Nineveh also, if they can do tshuva. So Yonah took Moshe Rabbeinu's position, you could say, almost to the next level, but it was an unacceptable level. So that is Yonah. But back to Eliyahu. What we see from the Mechilta is that Eliyahu is actually criticized for speaking about the Jewish people in this way. Es brischa hiferu, and Hashem retires him prematurely, it seems. Interestingly, and important to point out, Eliyahu is not indicted for confronting the Jewish people when need be. He is not indicted for killing all those prophets of Baal. That was something that needed to be done. When he's dealing with the Jewish people, he needs to deal with them. And incidentally, so did Moshe. Shevet Levi, they executed 3,000 people before Moshe comes back to Hashem. Whatever needs to happen in dealing with the Jewish people, that needs to happen. But when you're talking to Hashem about the Jewish people, that's already a different story. And that's where Eliyahu is indicted for speaking in criticism of the Jewish people, with nothing to say in their favor or in their defense. And in fact, there is a follow-up to this discussion, which begins with the Medrash, but it's to be found in the Tshuvas of the Radvaz. The Radvaz, as we know, prolific responser, many, many hundreds of Tshuvas. And in Tshuva number 2294, the Radvaz discusses Eliyahu HaNavi. And if we take a look at just a couple of the psukim to get our bearings, so it's about 6 or 7 psukim in. It's in Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Ches. We'll read just 2 or 3 psukim to see where the Radvaz is commenting on. So Eliyahu has to run away. Izebel has heard about the confrontation in Har HaKarmel. She's threatened to kill him, and he believes her. So he runs away. And Malach gives him this Ugas Ritzofim, this cake, and then he eats it, and then he doesn't eat again for 40 days. Vayelech b'koch ha'chila hi arboim yom v'arboim laila, and he runs, and he's running for 40 days. It's a long time. And where does he arrive? At Har Ha'elokim Chorev. He arrives at none other than Har Chorev, Har Sinai. And then Hashem appears to him. Vayavo sham el hamara vayolen sham. He comes to a cave. And we know there's a cave there in Har Chorev. That's Yud Gimel Midas. And Bine Dvar Hashem Elav Vayomelo, Hashem communicates with him and says, Ma lecha po Eliyahu? What are you doing here? Vayomer, and these are Eliyahu's words, Kano kinesil Hashem elokei tzavakos, I've been zealous on Hashem's behalf, ki ozvu brischa b'nei Yisrael, they've abandoned your bris, etc., and so forth. Now, the Radvaz asks a simple question, and that is, Hashem clearly wishes to communicate with Eliyahu HaNavi, but he waits a long time. 40 days is a long time. That means that Eliyahu starts running on day one, and Hashem lets him run and run and run, and it's 40 days, he's not eating, he's not drinking, and then he gets to Churv, and then Hashem appears to him and says, what are you doing here? Well, why should he need to be there in order for you to ask what he's doing there? You can stop him on day one and say, what are you doing wherever you are? Eliyahu's claim remains the same. And that's why the Radvaz says something spectacular. And that is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu initially does not wish to communicate with Eliyahu. Rather, he wants Eliyahu to learn a lesson. What lesson is there to be learned? As we mentioned before, one of those who stands out in their unflagging and unwavering defense on the behalf of the Jewish people is Moshe Rabbeinu. Says Radvaz, isn't it interesting to see exactly where Eliyahu's trip takes him? Isn't it interesting that more or less everything that is said about this journey of Eliyahu already has a precedent in the life of Moshe Rabbeinu? What do we see about him? He goes for 40 days and 40 nights without eating or drinking. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. And where does he find himself? In the cave in Har Chorev. That's where Moshe Rabbeinu was. In other words, and perhaps there's more than one way to say this, but the Radvaz says Hashem is leading Eliyahu almost, one could say, in the footsteps of Moshe Rabbeinu. He's kind of he's following the trail of Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? Why does he want him to go through what Moshe went through? Because he wants Eliyahu to pick up on the association and perhaps learn a lesson from Moshe, to be more Moshe Rabbeinu-dic in terms of the way that he goes about things and the way that he talks about the Jewish people. And that's the Emek, says the Radvaz. That's really the deeper understanding. He's sent Eliyahu in the footsteps of Moshe Rabbeinu. 40 days, 40 nights, no eating, no drinking. Finds himself in Sinai, and then Hashem appears to him and says, what are you doing here? Malecha po Eliyahu, as if to say, look where you are. Have you contemplated that? Who else was here first? Do you think you have something to learn from them? Malecha po Eliyahu. It was only that, even in spite of all that, that Eliyahu says Kano Kinesi means he was so focused on his zealousness on behalf of Hashem. And again, there are greater problems to have, but he did not pick up on the Moshe Rabbeinu message, and that's the point when Hashem had him replaced. So that's a really fascinating explanation of the Radvaz in terms of these psukim, what exactly was happening here, and why Hashem waited, and why he waited till Eliyahu got to that particular point. Based on all the above, when we consider, once again, we have the Pirkei Rabbeinu, which says that in response to Eliyahu saying, I'm constantly zealous, Hashem says, well, you're zealous the whole time, you'll be there at every bris. But then when we consider that in light of the Mechilta, which speaks in criticism of Eliyahu, for speaking in criticism of the Jewish people and not defending them, it is for that reason that there are certain Meforshim, among them the Drisha in his commentary to the Tur, Yeridea, and also the Radal, Rabbi David Luria, in his Perush on the Pirkei Rabbeinu, who both independently explain that when Hashem says to Eliyahu, you're constantly zealous, therefore you will be at every bris, it was actually as a form of a penalty for Eliyahu, not the reward. As if to say, it's not the reward for being so zealous, you'll see the fruits of your labors. in every bris. But rather, you said that they violated the bris. You then now will witness that the Jewish people continue the bris. And whenever they do, you'll be there just to remember that you said that this is something that they neglected. You'll see the Jewish people do not neglect, which is quite a chiddush. And still, the Pirkei Blessed says it's the Moshe of Kavod. You give Kavod to Eliyahu, but the background to him being there is that it's an indictment for Eliyahu saying that the Jewish people abandoned the bris. The Jewish people have not abandoned the bris. So that's quite a discussion with regards to what to make of Eliyahu's presence there in the bris and what it's doing. Interestingly, again, we're conscious the whole time of the background. Eliyahu part 1 and Eliyahu part 2, meaning Eliyahu as Pinchas and Eliyahu as himself. Because initially, if we take the full scope of the discussions of Chazal, we see that initially, as Pinchas, meaning in episode 1, so to speak, Eliyahu was Tovei HaKavod HaBen. He did take up the cause of the Jewish people and even confronted HaKadosh Baruch Hu over them, which is more than Moshe did. Moshe responded, but Pinchas confronts him. What's the background to this? The Pasuk says in Tehillim, there's a few prokem of Tehillim, the longer ones, which are almost like a sweep through Jewish history. And one of these prokem is Perek Kuf Vav. And in Pasuk Lamed there of Kuf Vav, when it talks about the episode at the end of last week's Parsha, Baal Peor and Zimri and Cosby, it says, Vaya'amod Pinchas Vayefalel. Now, it does not say vayispalel, although there is a drasha elsewhere which darshans it as an expression of tefillah, ein amida ela tefillah, but that's a drasha. But the pashtus of the word vayispalel is from the word plilim, meaning law. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin, daf pei beis amud aleph, explains, melamed she'asa plilus in kono. He brought almost like a suit against his maker. He brought a legal case against his maker, as if to say, in the words of the Gemara, Amar al Elu Yiplu Esrim Va'arba Elef Yisrael, over these two, Zimri and Cosby, 24,000 of Yisrael should fall. Rhetorical? That's his case. And really what Pinchas is saying, clearly there's many layers to it, but he's basically saying it can't be that as a result of the wrongdoing of these two people, a plague should wipe out so many other people. He doesn't know that they're innocent. He just knows they're Jewish. And clearly Hashem has his reasons, but Pinchas still contests it. And the Pasuk says, Vayamod Pinchas Vayifalel, Vateyatzar HaMagefa, and the plague stops. Which means, according to the Gemara, the cessation of that plague, which was just ravaging throughout the people, was not only a product of Pinchas' act of zealotry on Hashem's behalf by killing Zimri and Cosby, but also his act of zealotry on the Jewish people's behalf by making that claim. Vayifalel, vateyatzar magefa. So it's very interesting, especially in light of the fact that later on Eliyahu will be criticized for not being Tovei HaKavod HaBen, for sticking up for the Jewish people, pleading their cause. Initially he did, which then becomes a bit of a mysterious entity as to where exactly did that aspect of his repertoire go. Initially he's Tovei both. He's Tovei HaKavod HaShem, no question about it. He kills Zimri and Cosby. I mean, that's called Tovei HaKavod HaShem. But he's Tovei HaKavod HaBen. He's both engines are running, but somehow one of them cut out by the time he came to be Eliyahu, worthwhile pondering exactly what happened there. What we do see is an important lesson. We're not on the level, not of Pinchas, not Eliyahu, not all of those other illustrious people. But what's true for them, in principle, is true for us, as if to say, regardless of how a person needs to confront that which needs to be confronted, but we do see from the Mechilta, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself is never interested in hearing anything other than someone who pleads the cause of the Jewish people. He's well aware of their problems, probably more than we are. But in terms of what we can do for them in talking to him, only ever to plead their cause. That's certainly a lesson that we can learn. What's very interesting is, there is a bit of a PS to this issue with Pinchas, with Eliyahu, and he's at every bris. It actually ends up being to our benefit, according to the Medrash. The Medrash, it was made famous through the Hasidic master the Bnei Yisachar, Tzvi Elimelech of Dinov. And the Medrash states, this is a good Medrash to do Chazara on if a person is ever on their way to a bris. While well, you're waiting for them all. Omar Eliyahu. Eliyahu says, and the background is Hashem says, will be at every bris. So Eliyahu says, I have certain requirements if I'm going to attend. Not in terms of Heksher, but in terms of other things. Kivan Shemidasi Shani Mekane. You know me. I'm a zealous individual. That's the way I am. Velo uchal lisbol chet va'avon. I cannot bear the presence of sin. So there could be a problem. Pen ye avia ben hamachnis lebris balavera. So you tell me I'm invited to every bris. I'm happy to turn up, but I am not happy to be in the company of a person who does averas. What if the father of the son? What if he does averas? Velo uchal lisbol, that will be unbearable for me. That's the price Elio demands. In your honor and in recognition of you being there, I will atone for any averas that the father has. So then Elio presses on here and says, well, there's other people at the bris. Okay, we've dealt with the father, but what about the balabris? What about the moel? They could also be averas. Hashem says, achaper lahem gamkin. And then Eliyahu says, but what about everyone else who's invited? Pen yu ha'omdim shambali averos, ve'eshe b'akadosh baruch hu, she'yichaper l'chol ha'omdim b'abris. Anyone who turns up at a bris gets instant kapara, because otherwise Eliyahu is not going to come. So he's good company in the end. The question is, what does this mean? As if to say, what are we to make of this? Getting kapara is normally harder than that. It involves things like Yom Kippur. It involves things like tshuva. And seemingly, here, it's automatic. Because if it's not automatic, then Eliyahu could still cause problems. Because he'll say, well, what if they don't do tshuva? And it sounds like it is an absolute. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zatzal, used to discuss this frequently. When he was on the way to the bris, he always pondered this medrash. I mean, how can it be? It seems to have no rules. But Rather says, in fact, he famously once asked this question to Rav Cheskel Levinstein, who was the Mashgiach of Mir, and then Ponovich. And Rav Shlomo Zalman says, you know, the Medrash says you go to a bris, you get kapar. How does it work? Rav Cheskel Levinstein perhaps typically says, I don't care. if Hashem is offering me kapar, I'm going to take it. I'll find out how it works afterwards. But Rav Shlomo Zalman used to ponder this. He would discuss it with people. And in fact, there was someone who once accompanied Rav Shlomo Zalman to a bris. And the whole way to the bris, Rav Shlomo Zalman was saying, how does it work? You get kapara. It must be, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, that it's like this moment of grace, but you've got to adhere to it. You have to stick by it, as if to say, it's very well to get a clean state, but then keep it as you leave. It's something to live up to. And that was his suggestion. And I believe it is worthwhile to continue the description of what happened, because what is about to happen is also Torah. They've been discussing this medrash for a good 10-20 minutes, and then they come to the bris. And they're waiting for the bris to start, and the grandfather of the son comes over to Shlomo Zalman and says, Rav Orbach, if we have a few moments, I'd just like to share with you something I thought it was remarkable, and perhaps you'll agree. And he begins to tell Shlomo Zalman this medrash that they've been discussing for the last 10 or 20 minutes and already been dissecting. And where's the Toras Chaim here? So the one who tells the story says, you had to have seen Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's face as this grandfather, this proud grandfather, is telling him this medrash. He looked like he'd never heard anything before. He'd he'd never heard, just stood there with his mouth open, just absolutely flabbergasted by this medrash, which he knew very well. But he also knew that the grandfather would take a great deal of pleasure in relating this to him, and therefore he mamish made like he never heard it. And if you looked at him, you would believe that he'd never, ever heard this medrash before, as opposed to having been discussing it the entire way to the bris. And when he's finished, he says, I can't believe it. That's absolutely incredible. But how do you understand it? And he engaged his grandfather in the discussion himself. Both parts of that episode, I believe, are Torah. One's Torah Samedrish and one is Torah of Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So these are some discussions worthwhile mentioning. Again, certainly if there's a quiet moment at the bris, it's worthwhile informing people about it. So that's Pinchas's Eliyahu. As we move on in the Parsha, we get to Perek Kaf Zayin, which is the appointment of Yehoshua, interestingly, and obviously for very different reasons, another secession, whereby Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to be able to go into Eretz Canaan, and he's told to anoint Yehoshua, which he does. And there's a well-known statement, this is Vayismoch Yadav Alav Vayivarcheyu, he places his hands on him and he blesses him, and with a full heart, he appoints Yehoshua. And there's a well-known statement of the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra, on Daf Ayin Hei Amad Aleph, with regards to Moshe and Yehoshua, comparing them. What does the Gemara say? Zekeinim Sheba'oso Ador, the elders in that generation, they looked at this scene, here's Moshe, here's Yehoshua, and they said, you know, Yehoshua is not like Moshe. Pnei Moshe ke pnei chama. Moshe's countenance is like the sun. Pnei Yehoshua ke pnei levona. Yehoshua is like the moon. It glows, but it's not like the sun. As if to say, kimtas nish to Moshe Rabbeinu. But then they said, oila la'osa busha, oila la'osa chlima. Woe to that embarrassment, woe to that shame. And the question that Mefarshim ask is, what's the meaning of the second half of the sentence? You say Moshe's like this, Yeshua's like this, and then go on to say, oila la'osa busha, oila la'osa chlima. What's busha and what's chlima? And why are either of them relevant here? It's a good thing. It's a wonderful thing that's happening. Moshe was a leader now. Yeshua was a leader. One should rejoice, not feel either embarrassment nor shame. And this is a question that, needless to say, has attracted the attention of many Mefarshim. The Chofetz Chaim, when he spoke about this, explained as follows. You know, it's interesting that busha and klima, they're both types of embarrassment or shame, but they actually have quite a different atmosphere to them, because sometimes a person can be embarrassed without it necessarily reflecting badly on them. I think we often find, for example, when you're in the presence of greatness, you see something which is just totally beyond. Someone feels a sense of maybe inadequacy. That's its own type of embarrassment. That's good. Busha is considered to be a good midah. The Jewish people are called by shonim, not that they're constantly embarrassed because they've done something wrong, but they're aware of their finiteness, their inadequacy in the face of the infinite, or in the face of someone who's much, much greater than them. It's a good midah. It doesn't have any negative connotations at all. One should be, on the contrary, the Gemara speaks very denigratingly. For a person who doesn't have busha, for a person who has no sense of shame, then that's just called chutzpah. That's not good at all. There's no reverence, there's no sense of self-effacement or any such like sentiment. That's busha. Busha is good. Klima is not good. Klima, halosi kalein, is always when something bad has happened. It really is that type of shame that comes with a wrongdoing or an inadequacy that shouldn't have been there. That's busha and klima. And the question is, how does this relate to Moshe and Yehoshua? When they look at Moshe, they look at Yehoshua, they say, oila la'osa busha, oila la'osa klima. How does one feed into the other? So the Chofetz Chaim says, you know, the zakenim, it's very interesting to consider at the elders of that generation. That means that they know Moshe, but if they're the elders of the generation, that means that they grew up with Yehoshua. And now the question is, how do they rate themselves vis-a-vis Moshe and vis-a-vis Yeshua? From a certain point of view, when everyone looks at no one feels bad when they look at Moshe, because he's just so beyond everyone else. He's just from the outset, the house is full of light when he's born, and he brought them the Torah, and he's just at a different level. He's in a league of his own from the beginning. And therefore, he's almost like this luminous source of light itself. Pnei Moshe ke Pnei Chama. It's hard even to look at him. So when people look or contemplate Moshe Rabbeinu, the feeling is busha, as if to say, and it's good. It's not a statement, negative statement about anyone else. It's just there's Moshe Rabbeinu, and they realize he's so much greater than them, and that leads a sense of busha, and that's okay. But does the Kainim also look at Yehoshua? And as we know, the moon receives light from the sun, and it begins to shine itself. And that bred a different feeling among them. Because they grew up with Yehoshua. And Yehoshua actually started just like them. There was a time that he was a student when they were students, and somehow something happened. In other words, Yehoshua is their peer. He's their fellow. He's their equal. But somehow he's become more equal than them. And he now has emerged as the new leader. And when they look at Yehoshua as an absolute reflection of the light of Moshe Rabbeinu, that bred them to a sense of klima, because each of them could have been the next Yehoshua. They grew up the same way. But they saw that he put himself out to the extent that they didn't. And that's already a sense of shortcoming within themselves. So when they contemplate, you see how it divides up now. When they contemplate the sun, Pnei Chama of Moshe, that leads to Busha. But when they contemplate the Pnei Levana, Pnei Yeshua, Pnei Levana, that's already a sense of Klima. Each one of them is saying, I could have been the next Yeshua, but I wasn't, and he was. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, Zatzal, is quoted as having taken a somewhat different approach. It's interesting to discuss once in a while. As we know, we look at the leaders, and the leader of the next generation is often not the same stature as the leader of the previous generation. And every generation thinks they're the first generation to notice that. That's because they're the first generation to have experienced it. I once had the pleasure of being at a Shabbos guest at a Talmud of Moshe Feinstein. And he was, of course, talking about Moshe. And so one of the guests says, you know, there's no Moshes anymore. Which is true. But then this Talmud says, just Leman HaEmes, he says, it is true, there's no Moshes anymore. But you probably can't appreciate that in the time of Moshe, people were saying there's no Chofetz Chaims anymore. And then when the Chofetz Chaim, there's no Rabbi Kiva Egers anymore, and there's no Vilna Gaons anymore. So every generation has it. It feels that it's the one that fell off the edge and has experienced the first sharp decline. It's an ongoing thing. But there is a reciprocal relationship between the stature of the leader and the stature of the people. And as Reb Chaim Shulevitz used to say, there's a reason why the leaders are not of the same stature, because the generation is not always of the same stature. And they need to be able to relate to the people that are their gedolim. And therefore, Rabbi Zalman said, as we see, even with Moshe Rabbeinu, his level, ultimately, was parallel to the level of the Jewish people. When they fell, he got demoted. Reid Migdulascha, at the time of the Chet HaEgel, he was demoted. And when they're rehabilitated, he's reinstated. And certainly as it moves from Moshe to Yehoshua, and they saw, what a drop. But then they realized, if there's been such a drop between Moshe and Yehoshua, there must be a drop between the generation of Moshe and the generation of Yehoshua. And maybe we're responsible for that. We're part of that generation. And that's the busha and the klima that they were decrying. As they saw the disparity between the leaders, it led them to recognize there must be a parallel disparity between the generations. That's already something for them to think about. It's the final comment on this Oilo Lo Sabusha, which is really from a very different angle. It's found in the writings of the Chidah, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai. And he refers us to a well-known statement of Chazal, where what was it that Yehoshua propelled him to become the leader of the next generation. So it's not the most intuitive thing. The Medrash says that he learned and he sat on the benches like everyone else and learned from Moshe Rabbeinu, but he always got there early to set up, and he stayed late in order to organize things, to arrange things. He would arrange the benches, and nowadays we would say the shtenders, and whatever it is that they had. And somehow that became an outstanding merit. It means he invested absolutely in the teachings of Moshe Rabbeinu, not only in the intellectual sphere, absorbing the teachings, but also in absolutely every respect. And that vouchsafed him, and that propelled him to a higher level. So the Chidah says, no one else did that. No one else got there early to set up. No one else stayed to clear up. Why not? So the Chidah says, one can understand. It's embarrassing. After all, self-respecting, budding Torah scholar, he's there for the learning. He's not there for the arranging the furniture. And therefore there was a sense of, on whatever level, of covered a little bit. Lo lefi erkom, lo lefi chvodam. You're going to set up? No, someone else can set up. When it's all set up, then I'll make my entrance, and then we'll start the real business of learning. So everyone was embarrassed to set up. The only person who overcame that embarrassment was Yeshua, because Yeshua said, "This is also important, and it's when the Rebbe comes, the place has to be arranged. It's worth it." And he overcame it, and no one else did. And look what happened. Years later, he's the leader, and not them. And the Zakenim looked at him and said, the only difference in terms of behaviorally that we can see between us and them is that we were embarrassed to set up, and Yeshua wasn't, and we lost out. And that's why they said, look, he's absorbed everything from Moshe. Pnei Moshe kepnei Chama, pnei Yeshua kepnei Levana, but not us, because we were embarrassed. Oy la la osa busha, oy la osa klima. Woe to us over that embarrassment that we felt, because we lost out, because we didn't emulate or accompany Yeshua as he was setting up. And perhaps one can conclude by certain words of explanation here. It's a symptom. The fact that Yeshua is prepared to set up means he's prepared to do whatever it takes in order for Moshe's teachings to be fully absorbed. And that can find its way into the teachings themselves. Very often something is not sufficiently clear, and the question is, does one ask, does one inquire? If you ask for it to be repeated, if you ask for someone to clarify, either Moshe himself or one of your chaverim, so you're admitting that you didn't know. And that's why the Medrash says, or the Gemara says, that Divrei Torah are like water. They always reach the bottommost point, because whoever holds themselves higher, so there's certain things, he'll miss them, and he won't go back for them, because he can't bring himself to say, I didn't understand it the first time, or it's not sufficiently clear to me. And therefore, perhaps one could say that Yeshua's preparedness to forego his honor in order that the shir should be understood, that found expression in the learning itself. There was no stone he left unturned. There was no thing that he left unresolved. And if he needed help, he asked for it. And therefore, he was the one who absorbed fully. And once again, we begin with the lofty personalities of Moshe and Yeshua, and their level is not our level, but the principle remains that when it comes to words of Torah, the more we put our covered in front, the more we're perhaps blocking clarity and a depth of understanding in certain things. That's a further lesson from Yeshua himself. We'll leave it over there for this evening.